Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West.
Writers Craig Lancaster and Elisa Lorello started their careers on similar paths. Both self-published their first novels, which went on to become incredible hits.
The couple met at an industry party in 2011 and became fast friends. Their friendship grew into a long-distance relationship, and the couple were married a few years later. They currently make their home in Billings and have authored a combined 16 books to date.
They joined us in the studio to discuss their most recent work, including a surprise project they reveal on air.
Welcome to the studio. It's so wonderful to have you both here today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So before we get into the nitty-gritty of writing and publishing, I have a question that involves romance.
Yes.
How did you guys meet?
Do you want to start?
Oh, okay. Well, we could do a he said, she said probably with this. We were signed by our publisher around the same time. And this is going back to 2011, and they had a party in New York City during the BEA, which is the Book Expo of America. And they flew all of their authors in from everywhere, and basically
we had one duty.
We had
one duty, and it was to show up at this industry party.
Right.
And so I walked in, and there was so much naked ambition in the room that I proceeded to get drunk.
And I was the only one not drinking at the party, with the exception of my very good friend who co-wrote Why I Love Singlehood. Because we were signed around the same time, our names were coming up in press releases, and I had seen his people talking about him in forums and his book, which was at the time 600 Hours of Edward. And so I just figured, oh, I'll meet this guy. So I introduced myself, and he promptly said,
"How you doing?" Because I was in a happy place.
It was very charming, right?
Oh, gosh.
At the end of the night, I said to Sarah, my co-author, I said, "I don't know about that Lancaster guy."
And the thing I always have to back up and tell people is I was married at the time. My wife was there with me. So it wasn't like there was fireworks and all this. It was a very slow kind of thing that we just kind of became friends. Later on, when circumstances changed and it became what it's become. So,
and you've been married for how long now?
A little over a year. It was October 1st, 2016. Yeah, coming up on 3 years together, I think. So,
and I imagine your household is just full of words. I mean, you're stumbling over them everywhere.
Right now, we're stumbling over boxes, but yeah, you know, we've managed to make that part of it work pretty well. We write different things. We're supportive of each other, but we're not too awfully competitive. It's a real good balance.
Craig, I know this story, but I think our listeners probably don't. Tell how you came about writing 600 Hours of Edward. It is a sort of phenomena of publishing and writing.
It is, because it kind of came out of nowhere. In the fall of 2008, a buddy of mine asked me to do National Novel Writing Month with him, just as a way we'll keep each other honest, we'll have somebody to be accountable to with our word count goals and all that. And I begged off. I'd had a pretty rough year. I had a really bad motorcycle accident in that summer, and I was still recovering. And then I started thinking about Edward, who is this guy who is so bound by his routines that he gets into these ruts and he irritates other people and all of this. So I started thinking about this guy and thinking about the dramatic and comedic possibilities of that. So I called my buddy and I said, "All right, I'll do this." And so I started on November 1st, like National Novel Writing Month demands. And I started writing every day. Well, actually, that's not true. I mean, I took several days off, which makes the ultimate word count all the more bizarre. So I ended up writing the whole 81,000 word manuscript in the first 25 days of November, and sort of haphazardly self-published it because I didn't have any expectations for it. And it started getting read by people, most notably Chris Cobble at Riverbend Publishing in Helena, who several months later said, I want to publish this book. And I, okay, that's fine by me. And within, gosh, it came out in October of that year. And I think by December, it was a Montana honor book. And I'm standing there with Jamie Ford at the library in Bozeman. And it, you know, won a High Plains Book Award, which I think I was the first Billings writer to win. Yeah. And the whole thing was just completely bizarre. It was like living somebody else's life, you know, because I had just tossed it off.
And I will confess, Craig, that you gave me a copy of your self-published book, which I promptly put down on a coffee table and ignored it until my sister calls me and tells me about it. And then Chris Cobble calls me and tells me about it. And I thought, you know, I think I have that book here somewhere.
Yeah.
And I read it in a day and, as did everybody, fell in love with the character of Edward.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, it's funny how those things go, you know. I remember that conversation with you, and you were very polite and just kind of said, you know, self-published books, we don't really do that. You know, I know it's ascendant. You know, I think here, almost 10 years later, you know, everybody's tune has changed on that. But at the time, it was kind of a, I don't think it was daring so much as stupid thing to do, but the stupidity worked out for me.
Well, and looking back, you said almost 10 years later, you sort of lucked into novel writing, and here you are, just incredibly prolific, have been publishing ever since. Did you ever see this path coming? Obviously, it feels like not.
No, not really. I mean, I always hoped that I would write a novel. That seemed like, you know, if you had a literary bent, I was a newspaper man, and I always felt like that would be the serious kind of writing that, you know, if I could manage to do it, I could kind of hang my hat on that and say, yeah, I wrote a novel. I'd never expected to write seven of them, you know, well, eight and seven published. You know, that part of it, yeah, some key got turned in that whole process. And, you know, now I get to look at it and go, well, you know, some of them fly, some of them sink. My perspective is wildly different than it was 10 years ago.
I think a lot of our listeners probably know your work, but Elisa, your first novel, Faking It, people may not know the premise of that. And that's a very unusual story, too. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Andy and Devin?
Absolutely. So that idea was actually born in 1999, there was a new show called Sex and the City. And I was getting ready to graduate with my bachelor's degree that year. I went back to college a little bit late. So I was actually 29 when I was a senior. And I was watching the show very stealthily. I wasn't telling my roommates that I was watching it, and I didn't really know how I felt about it. But one of the things I was kind of wrestling with at the time was my own background of, God, I never would have talked about this stuff in public. and so that started a little thread of thought of, well, what if this very inhibited woman meets this very uninhibited guy? So that was kind of the first what if. And then the second what if was, and what if they become friends? Because When Harry Met Sally is one of my all-time favorite movies. So that just very naturally followed. And then I was saying, well, that's cute, but I'm not a fiction writer. I'm really not a novelist. I'm more into nonfiction. And I was getting ready to graduate, and I did, and I went straight in, well, about 6 months later, I went to grad school, and then I got very immersed in that. But these characters were not waiting for me. They kept talking, and pretty soon I said, well, what if he's an escort? What if they have an arrangement, and he teaches her how to be a better lover?
There's kind of a deal going on there.
There's absolutely.
There?
There's some bartering there. And for a while, I was saying, well, what is she going to teach him? And I didn't really have that piece. And then when I got my master's degree, I'm like, hello, have her teach him about writing. And it's a wonderfully rhetorical novel. It's this, a lot of this back and forth, a lot of Socratic exchanges going on, and each one kind of pushing each other's buttons and calling each other out. And I loved that dynamic. When I finally finished it and I was saying, I think this is good, you know, because again, at that point I was saying, I'm not a fiction writer, but I had to just write it to get it out of my head because it wasn't leaving me alone. The interesting thing is, even though I have this degree in professional writing, we actually didn't talk about publishing. And so I kind of had to figure all that out on my own. What do I do now with this?
Yeah, it's one thing to have those characters living in you and then coming out onto the page. It's a whole other thing to turn that into a publishable work that is mass produced. And Faking It has become your biggest seller.
Absolutely. And that I self-published. So I kind of did the same thing Craig did. And I self-published, I think, in 2009. But in 2010, it completely catapulted up the ebook chart.
Any sequels on the way?
Yes, there are. there actually are two sequels. There's Ordinary World, which takes place 5 years after Where Faking It Leaves Off. And then there's She Has Your Eyes. And I'm actually going to be releasing it within the next couple of weeks. I did a spin-off of She Has Your Eyes. So
I'm interested in the idea of sequels. And certainly, Craig, this is a good question for you or for both of you. Do the characters just not let go? I mean, do they start having their own story to tell? I was so happy to see Edward show up again and some of the characters in that story. Do you want to talk about writing two sequels to your first book?
Yeah, because it's instructive, I think, how I can't really put any controls on things. If you dig far enough into the internet, there are all these pronouncements by me in 2009 and 2010 that I'm done writing Edward. I said everything I need to say. And then in late 2012, he taps me on the shoulder and says, no. And it really was not a conscious decision of, gee, I think I'd like to write another Edward book. But once the idea took root, I had to write it. And the same thing was true with the third one. And so I've learned in a hard way to not say, this is what I'm going to do, because I don't know. And that's, you know, in terms of artistic growth, that's probably one of the biggest lessons I've learned, is to just wait for it. Don't control it. Just wait for it to show up. Wait for the idea. Wait for the thing that makes you say, I got to write. And that's what you ought to be writing.
Those are those characters that tap you on the shoulder and suddenly they won't shut up, huh?
Absolutely. And it sounds so, I'm going to use a real technical term here. It sounds so artsy fartsy when you say that, but it's actually the way it works. You get told, hey, I'm ready to talk.
And I had a similar experience with Andy and Devin, who is also David. And in the later books, he's more known as David. By the end of Faking It, I already knew then her story wasn't finished yet by the end of that novel. So I knew there was going to be at least the one sequel. When the third book came out, I didn't have that in mind originally. And same thing, that came out several years later. Because the series is so popular, I'm asked that a lot. Is there going to be another Andy and David book? And I say, I don't know until they tell me.
Now, you have a book titled The Writer's Habit. It was published last spring. Makes me curious about your particular writing habits. What are things that you do as a writer that are part of your routine?
That's an interesting question. It's funny. I don't know that I'm that meta reflective with it. I definitely write just about every day, but it's not necessarily directed. So in other words, I'm doing journaling, some form of journaling just about every day. I'm doing some form of blogging on a regular basis. I'm doing fiction writing, or I'm doing so there's always composition taking place. And that's a very comforting thing. And if I'm not even physically doing it while I'm walking the track at the Y, it's happening. And then when I actually sit down to do something, a big project like a novel, for example, then I'm pretty locked in on that. But there's also a bit of self-talk going on in there. There are times when I've had to literally type in the draft, "This is allowed to be bad." Yes. Because I'm you know,
get
nervous.
It out there and go back to it later. Right. But it has to be down on the page.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So,
well, you're both incredibly prolific. You have 10 books, is that right?
That sounds right.
And Craig, you've had 8 books in 8 years. It sounds like you've kept pretty busy.
Yeah, it's not a bad life. It beats digging a hole. Yeah, I just like to do it. It's just fun.
Mm. Although I work quite a bit differently from the way she works, because I tend to take a lot of time off between. It doesn't sound like it. You know, when you say 8 books in 8 years, you would think I was writing all the time, but I'm really not. I once I commit myself, I tend to go and then pound it out, work it over.
So your habits are more centered on ruminating, perhaps.
I spend a lot of time inside my own head, for better and for worse. What's interesting now is that other things have kind of come into my life, and so the thing I'm working on now, I've been working on for quite a while. And so I'm learning this new way of do a little, set it down for a while, come back to it, find the thread again, do a little more. And it's working. And so I'm like a guy with a bad golf swing. You know, if the ball's going straight and at distance, I'm not going to argue with how it is that I'm managing to do that.
I want to know, what are you working on now?
Well, why don't we tell you what we finished? And you'll be the first to hear this.
Ooh, a scoop. I love
scoop.
It.
We're, yeah. We're scooping you.
Let's hear it.
So we've been public with the fact that Elisa has finished a novel and submitted it to her agent. I finished one, submitted it to my agent. What we haven't told people is that, A, the agent is the same person, and the novel that got submitted in both cases was one we wrote together.
Oh, how exciting. I love the smiles on your faces right now. This yeah. has got to be such a fun project.
Well, it was scary, because we thought that we had the compatibility to do it, but had it gone sideways, that could have turned out to be a pretty ugly thing. And we were risking more than just a project. We were risking how we get along with each other. But I'm pleased to say that it was as seamless as everything else has been. Not that it didn't have its writing challenges. It certainly did. But the way we worked together turned out really well. So
And probably strengthened how you work together, not only as professionals, but as people.
It was a lot of trust involved. And I've done a couple of collaborations, and I find that is so, again, it's similar to any other relationship where you need to have that trust. But I find it, especially in writing relationships, that if that trust is missing, the collaboration just starts to fall apart. There was a lot of fun of looking forward to seeing what he did and then saying, oh, I know where I want to take this. And then he would have the same reaction, and he would get excited to see what I had written and the direction I took it in. Our vision was very locked in, and we knew what we wanted to do with it. So we really had a good time with it, and we loved the story, and we had fun, you know.
I was going to say it's more like a jazz jam, you know, yeah. Where it's like I'm going to lay down a few notes, and then it's over to you, Elisa, and she would pick it up and play off of that.
Wow, I really look forward to seeing that.
To
yeah, when will it be out in the world?
It's out making the rounds now, so we'll find out what its fate is soon, I hope.
Well, and it sounds like in between that, you're helping other writers build their own books and edit manuscripts. Are you enjoying that work?
I do. I do. I really like when I get a client who's got something of value to offer and needs the Sherpa to say, this is how you get there. So I tend to be kind of choosy with my projects. I don't want to shine somebody on and say, oh yeah, yeah, that book, there's a place for that, you know, when it's not ready.
Craig, I've always loved your books for the humor, the characters and the humor. It's just so delightful. And I read somewhere that you wrote a essay for the L.A. Times on living in hotel rooms.
The L.A. Review of Books, yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, one of the, you know, I said other things have come into my life. One of the things that I do is some pipeline safety work, which basically requires me to fly off into corners of the country that nobody goes to on vacation and work alone in pretty remote areas. So I live in hotels while I'm doing that. So I just wrote about motel living, and my editor, a guy named Tom Zellner, he challenged me to fold some public policy into it. You know, we've got them here in Billings, these crappy hotel, well, not hotels, motels, on the, you know, in the industrial part of town where you have working people living because they cannot afford first and last month's rent, or they don't have a credit report that would allow them to live in a more traditional way. That's a huge problem in this country. And in places where rents have gone stratospheric, it's an even bigger problem. So he challenged me to think a little deeper about it than just, you know, telling my funny tales of being in Lapeer, Michigan or something.
So it seems that your writing life is taking you in all kinds of directions, but one, very physically, is taking you out of Montana. Sounds like you're headed back east, where, Alisa, you grew up out east? Or?
I grew up in Long Island, and but I went to school in Massachusetts, so I spent about 10 years in southeastern Massachusetts. And then I lived in North Carolina for a while, so East Coast was always more my thing. In fact, before Craig and I got together, I hadn't been west of Chicago. So,
what do you think of this great Wild West?
It's, well, here's an example. The first time we drove, I think it was to Livingston. And
no, we were on our way to Seattle.
That's right. Yeah. We were doing a road trip to Seattle. And I had tennis neck, you know, looking to my left, to my right, to my left, to front and back. And I could not get over the vastness.
Well, we were in Columbus and she was going, this is the most incredible thing I've ever seen. And I, of course, knew what was coming, you know. I mean, Columbus is fine, but, you know, there are more exciting destinations to come on that particular trip. So I was just kind of, or she'd say, can you believe that? And then she goes, oh, yeah, you can believe that because you are here all the time. But it doesn't get old for me either. So.
Well, and a lot of Montana writers really do use place in their writing, but it seems like as far as the fiction worlds that you create, Billings has seeped in a little bit.
Absolutely. My latest one called Big Sky Littleton, I decided to set in Billings. And what I really did was I was too happy.
Oh, no.
you know, I had this wonderful long-distance relationship that, well, I had a great friendship that evolved into this long-distance relationship that evolved into this marriage and evolved into this relocation and meeting wonderful people and seeing incredible vistas and so on. And I was contracted. I actually had a two-book deal. So this was kind of book two in the two-book deal. And so I at first I was like, what am I going to write about? There's nothing, I'm not feeling anything. And I have no conflict in my life right now. This is too good. So I actually, what I wound up doing was turning my story completely on its head. So again, whereas I actually spent a summer here first before officially moving, and that's kind of when we call it, we test drove the relationship at that point to make sure this was the real deal. So this protagonist, Sky, relocates to meet this guy that, or to be with this guy that she met online. They only spent one weekend together, and before she even gets off the plane, she gets dumped. And then she's trying to figure out, is she going to stay in Billings and make a go of it, or is she going to move back to Rhode Island, is where she's from, and just kind of go back there with her tail between her legs because she's telling everybody about this wonderful life she's about to step into. And again, whereas I was immediately embraced here and immediately found community here, she's a little resistant to find community, and she's also finding herself in all of this. So I don't, in the beginning, she doesn't know where she fits in.
So fiction allows you to create conflict for your character.
Absolutely, yes. And actually, and it was fun.
I prefer it being in your narratives than in your personal lives, though. Is that true? I mean,
I don't know.
I don't write autobiographically, but I absolutely will. I call it, I stole this term from a cooking show. I repurpose things. It's not that I'm writing autobiographically, but I find these little bits of memory and or experiences, and I just use them in a way that really embodies what the character's going through.
It should be said that some writers are more aggressive than others in repurposing or outright, you know, grabbing and using. One of my favorite stories is about Pat Conroy. When he was still alive, he was at his mother's deathbed, and she looked at him and said, "Son, I'm having an exceedingly hard time dying knowing that you're going to run home and write everything down." And, you know, if you know Conroy's fiction, you know that's exactly what he did. So,
well, Craig, I think what people love about your books, whether it's Mile City or Sheridan or Driving Through Billings, is they're very familiar
sure.
with those places and landscape. Even though it's someone else's story, they can imagine being there.
Yeah, I get that a lot, which makes me feel like I did my job the right way. But I also like trying to break away from sort of the typical Montana hard earth story. Not that those aren't wonderful, but I'm not really qualified to write them. I grew up somewhere else, and I'm going to be an eternal outsider no matter how much time I spend in Montana. But I also just think, you know, Tom McGuane, I said this first, I think, but, you know, pizzas get delivered here. You know, it's not all just staring at the horizon, right? Yeah, so people sing karaoke badly here, and really badly. And so I like to try to tap into some of that, too.
I do have to say, though, obviously because I read Craig's books before, you know, while we were in this friendship, that when I visited here for the first time, I was like, oh, hey, there's the Babcock. Is that the Albertsons that Edward goes to? And so I did almost have a sense of familiarity, even though I had, again, like I said, I'd never been west of Chicago, yet setting foot in this city, there was already something. I had something to work with, so to speak. And that was, again, he did. He did his job really well.
Well, I want to thank you both for sharing your worldviews through your fiction and for taking part in a conversation. Before you venture off east, I know that we will miss having such talent near us, but luckily we are still able to get our hands on your books, so we look forward to what comes next.
Best of luck to both of you. Yes. You are not going to be short on stories.
Never.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
You've been listening to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, produced by Anna Page, Corby Skinner, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Nauman. Hear this program anytime online at ypradio.org.